So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming today, this morning. Let me just say, for anybody who is new, when Betsy said, now we bow to the Buddha, for many of us, we are not used to bowing to the Buddha, or a Buddha, or even bowing. So, let me just clarify what this is about. Again, bowing is not something that's unknown to Americans. I mean, in certain situations, we may bow, but it's certainly not part of our culture. But in Asia, where Buddhism is coming to us from, bowing is very much part of the culture, and it's really a sign of just respect. People bow to people. Children bow to their parents. So it's very much in the culture that when often you greet or showing respect or saying goodbye or anything, the same way we would shake hands or do other kinds of things, people bow. So again, that's all we're doing. We're kind of lowering the head a little bit in respect. So when we bow to the Buddha, you know, there is a representation of the Buddha that's kind of a focus because, I mean, in one way, I guess we could bow in any direction, in all directions. So we bow to a symbol. So what is it a symbol of that we're bowing to? Again, Buddha simply means an awakened one. So when Siddhartha Gautama had his enlightenment experience, when he woke up, from then on he was called the Buddha, the awakened one. So when we bow to the Buddha, we're really doing two things. Often in Buddhism, we talk about the absolute and the relative levels, the historical levels and the unconditioned or ahistorical levels. So on one hand, there is this historical tradition going back to Shakyamuni Buddha that has been passed on from the Buddha to his disciples, to his students, to their disciples and students for 2,600 years. This stream of awakening, of enlightenment, of kind of showing us the way, how to liberate ourselves from all our self-created sufferings, dissatisfactions, etc., and really teach us how to live a happy, meaningful, fulfilling life. This tradition of enlightenment, of awakening, is making it possible for us to be here, to talk about these teachings, to practice this teaching. So if there hadn't been a whole lineage of human beings passing it on, we wouldn't be here. And if we feel some sense of gratitude or appreciation that these teachings and practices are available, and that these people, you know, for thousands of years have continually cultivated to a very deep degree so it could be passed on authentically, to this lineage of human beings, going back to the Buddha for 2,500 years, we show respect and appreciation. But also, as I said, Buddha is more than just a body, the body of the Buddha. Buddha really means this awakened mind. And this awakened mind, this capacity for seeing clearly, this capacity for living life freely and naturally and openly, is also inherently our own mind. Each of us. And this was one of the great teachings of the Buddha, that he taught that, that in his own experience of full enlightenment, you know, his understanding was that every human being has this potential, because it is the very foundation of their own mind. He did not discover something foreign. He just uncovered the truth of reality, his own mind. And so when we bow to the Buddha, we are not only bowing to that historical tradition or lineage, but we're also taking a moment to acknowledge, to remember, to not forget that each of us have that potential within oneself. And so we are acknowledging that in that bow. And we are kind of appreciative and respectful because it is something wonderful. Without it, all we would be able to do is just endlessly, continually recreate our past. But because of this inherent potential for transformation that's in each of us, there is another way possible. So, therefore, that is all encapsulated in the bow. Bowing to the Buddha. I think that means she approves. Does that mean you approve? So I wanted to usually begin with taking questions, but there are some things from the past that, because we've always been taking questions, haven't gotten to. So I wanted to, this was somebody that's been here in this file for a while, and I hope I didn't talk about it in the past talk, but if I did, just tell me. But somebody either made a presentation or asked, you know, about, you know, practicing in one's daily life, in one's relationships, caring, all that thing, you know, why do it if so many people around me aren't doing it, right? Why, you know, why do it, right? If I'm the only one, you know, living this way or practicing this way, you know, and everybody else around me is just getting by or just, in, you know, or pretending they're doing it, and they're all a bunch of hypocrites, you know. But I'm, you know, why should I do it? So I think that's a, without going into why you might be someone who is so focused on what everybody else is doing and not what you're doing. So I think there's a fundamental problem with the question, but I won't go into that because I think at another level it's a good question, and I think it's especially a good question for people like us. I mean we don't all know each other, but I mean I would imagine everyone who's here, because we are somehow either trying to live our life or seeking something of value and meaning, which is probably not generally found in our culture. Right? So in a certain way, when one turns one's mind toward the values of living a life of meaning and purpose, and looking for happiness and well-being, not in the cultural norms of achievement or things or objects or materialism or consumerism or fame or celebrity, you know what I mean? When we are kind of seeing that as worthy goals or meaningful goals in life, in a certain way we are kind of out of step with many people around us. And so I think it points to, again, especially in our culture, where the forces of materialism, of consumerism, of conflict, of hatred and anger and violence and just, you know, so much the way we are so unkind to one another, from the top to the bottom. I think it really speaks to how important it is that we really be clear within ourselves what we're doing. Because I would say, at the truest level, our practice of our path, whatever our spiritual transformative path is, should be only based on our own aspiration. And what everybody else is doing should be immaterial. That one should have a sense of what is right, not what is right as opposed to what is wrong, but what is right in terms of a sense of rightness. And that one's commitment to living with that kind of inherent authenticity or integrity should be only fundamentally in the beginning for oneself. And whether anybody else is doing it or not doing it, or how they're doing it, should be immaterial. Why should I care when others don't? You see, that's that saying that I live my life based on what other people are doing. Right? Well, if they don't care, then I won't care. But that's a very skewed way, and there's no inherent truth or authenticity in that, right? It means that we are always a reflection. We are always reacting to what everybody else is doing. So we're sort of like chameleons, you know what I'm saying? Those kind of chameleons, you know, that are always taking on the coloration of whatever situation or environment they're in. I think it's important in this life that each of us, wherever we are, that we stand for something. It doesn't have to be big, it doesn't have to be grandiose. We don't have to think we're special. But it means that that the values that we think are noble in this life, and that we want to, we think, create a sense of well-being and goodness within all the actions of our own body, speech, and mind, and in our relationships with others, that we make a commitment to uphold them, irrespective, you know, of whether we get applause or not. Right? We know that, you know, many artists who are true to their art aren't necessarily always appreciated during the course of their artistic journey. Some of them may not be after they're dead. But again, knowing artists or whatever, that's often a commitment that one struggles with as an artist, right? How true am I to my art, to my vision, and how true am I to earning a living, getting by, or getting the social mores to approve of me, right? And that's something that one has to navigate. Right? How true are we to what we think is essential and important, and how we want to manifest? And this sort of leads to a, are there any questions about that? I mean, anybody? Yeah, so this kind of leads to, I think, another kind of a relevant point, and this came out of a conversation I had with somebody a couple of weeks ago, who basically, you know, life, their life is kind of a mess in all areas. And that's I think, a pretty fair assessment. But what became clear to me in talking to this person is that they didn't have a clue how they wanted to manifest in all the important areas of their life, you know? So when I said to them, well, you know, well, how do you want to be in relationships, right? And how do you want to manifest within the context of your family? And what, you know, and in terms of your work and, you know, what are your values, you know? And there was like a blank look, right? And so therefore, if there's no direction, then obviously what you're left with is what? Sort of getting by, right? Sort of dealing every situation on a case-by-case basis, but you have no reference with how to deal with it, right? And so I think that points to, I think, a very essential point of any kind of meaningful life, and I'm calling what's called a spiritual life, because that word has various connotations, but calling it, you know, leading a meaningful life, again, a life of integrity and a life of authenticity, you know, a life of goodness. That has to move from just a way of thinking about to it moves in the realm of intention, right? And I think that's what really a spiritual life is about, that one has a conscious intention about one's life. Right? And how one wants to live one's life, how one wants to manifest in this world, in all the areas of one's life. And that direction is what informs everything. Right? Because now we have a context to say yes or no to all the events and activities that arise constantly in our lives, right? At home, at work, in relationships, in society, there's a framework, there's a touchstone that we can refer to. So our choices in this life are wise and are congruent with, again, our inner values, but also where we want to get to. I mean, in other words, If I left here today and I had no idea where I wanted to go, I would either what? I would either just wander around the parking lot, right? Or else I get in my car and just drive off with no direction. Now, again, that may be an interesting life, right? Never knowing where I'm going and just, you know, whatever shows up. But after doing that for a number of years, you may find that it gets a little old. That maybe there's more to life than just endlessly having kind of random experiences. That there is, there may be places that I do really want to get to. In one of the kind of seminal texts of the Buddhist tradition, the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, called The Way of the Bodhisattva by this really profoundly wonderful 8th century master called Shantideva. It's a very famous text, very, very wonderful translations, and we've studied it many times in our community. It is a, for those of you who have some familiarity with Buddhist teaching, it is basically a very complete presentation of the whole Buddhist path from beginning to end, kind of based on what are called the six paramitas, such as generosity, meditation, wisdom, energy, interest, wisdom, things like that. But it's interesting that in the very first chapter, before he even begins to say anything about the Buddhist path, the first thing the first chapter is all about intention. I mean, there is nothing about, you know, practice, meditation, mindfulness, generosity, patience, you know, I mean, there's nothing about all the practices. He says, before you even jump into any of that, you know, where do you want to go in life? You know, what's your intention? Why are you doing all these practices? And so what he shares with us is that is the most important thing. You know, what is my intention? Why am I doing this? Why am I meditating? Why am I practicing mindfulness? Why am I doing this? Now, interestingly enough, he presents a very traditional response to that. He kind of gives us the answer for him, which is, it's a twofold answer. Onefold is simply the most meaningful way that one can use one's life, right? The gift of having a body and a mind. The most meaningful way that one could use that gift is to become awakened. That is the purpose of life. To free oneself from all limitation, to free oneself from all delusion, to free oneself from all self-created suffering and dissatisfaction, and to lead an awakened life, a free life, a noble life, right? And to use that awakened life to be of benefit to others. This is it. He says, this life is a life that produces happiness. This is a life that produces well-being, inner harmony and peace. This is the meaningful life. And when one discovers it for oneself, one naturally wants to share it with others, right? Because we are all interconnected. We are all related. We are all brothers and sisters. We are all family. We're all in this together. And for each of us to kind of work it out for ourselves and screw everybody else, would be the height of selfishness. And again, not acknowledging how we are all interconnected, how we all fundamentally affect one another, take care of one another, are the recipients of so much support and goodness from others. So for us to kind of only care about our own liberation and screw everybody else, everybody's on their own, this would be a kind of a misuse of this wonderful gift. So in Shantideva's text, he says, there is this intention, and then there is the actually doing, the action. But he says, even though the action is what brings a result, it's what's lived, he said the most important is the intention. And that this intention, in traditional Buddhism, it's called bodhicitta. It's called the cultivation of the enlightened mind, the awakened mind, this cultivation of this great heart that wants to awaken itself so it can benefit others. He says this intention, or this great thought of enlightenment, is something that has to be cultivated continually. It's not like you do it once. And he says it has to be cultivated continually because of our habit energy. Right? Our habit energy is so ensnared in delusion, in egoism, in egocentricity, in just being focused on taking care of our needs and always responding to our needs, or just getting our needs met. There's a famous line: a flash of lightning in the dark comes from Shantideva. He says, for most beings, if you kind of observe, if you could get inside their minds and listen, a frightening thought, he says, the frequency that a selfless, altruistic thought naturally and spontaneously arises in the mind, he says it's like a flash of lightning in the dark. One, it doesn't happen too often, but two, it's a very short duration. I mean, the analogy is, it's in that moment, right, of that flash of lightning in the dark, that all of a sudden, for a moment, what? Everything is lit up. We can see for a moment, but then the lightning dissipates and it's dark again. And so what he says is that this kind of altruistic heart, this kind of desire to lead a meaningful life, it's like a flash of light in the dark. It'll arise, and in that moment there'll be clarity, right, and purpose, but then it'll just close. And our habit energy, this powerful habit energy within the mind, reasserts itself. So he's very clear that this seed of enlightenment, this bodhicitta, this altruistic mind, has to be constantly cultivated. Right? So it will grow. And that if it's not cultivated, it will always be in, out, back, forth, a little of this, a little of that. But the energy that really fuels a healing and transformation will not be a consistent part of our life without this cultivation of this altruistic intention. So, and that again, coming back to where we started, is something very personal. There are many different, for those who've been around reading about Buddhism or going to various Buddhist groups, lots of different stuff out there. And many people think it's because because there are within formal Buddhism, really very beautiful prayers and things like that of aspiration, where one says, may I lead an altruistic life and dedicate myself to the full enlightenment of myself and others and work for the liberation of others, right? Those are wonderful things to say. And many people think they are practicing this altruistic path because they say those things. But saying and actually doing are very different. And saying words when they are really not congruent with one's heart-mind is also a very different experience. So, to read about and to think about this, And again, I mean, I don't know everybody here. People may be on different paths or different, but I would say whatever your aspiration is for yourself in this life, please understand that it's something that needs to be reflected on deeply. So it can be a consistent quality of your life. And then when in all your interactions, from the simplest, right, the most personal, human being to human being, at home, with family, with friends, with relationships, with work colleagues in society, that there is a seamless consistency of action. The word impeccable comes to mind. That we do our best to lead an impeccable life. It's sort of like, you know, when we do retreats. And I don't know how many people here have been on retreats, silent retreats. But I often caution people to say, please do not kind of go about this retreat like sort of you're, at sometimes you're on stage and then other times you're off stage. What that means, you know, when you're in the meditation hall or in the time of formal practice, you know, you're with the program. But then you get back to your room, you close the door, and it's like party time, you know. Time to, I can, you know, just indulge. Again, who are we fooling? Right? Who are we fooling? And then why are we practicing? So, again, when the practice becomes personal, at whatever level and whatever you're practicing, when it's personal, meaning it's inside you. It's something that you reflect on, right? It's like, I don't know, it's like you had this special thing that was very special to you. And every day you, you know, you looked at it. Every day you polished it. You know, it's like that. It's like something that you treasure, and you keep it clean, pure. And in a certain way, this mind, this altruistic mind, this mind that tells us to do good, that tells us put others ahead of ourselves, to not always be so selfish and self-centered, to let go, to be forgiving, to be understanding, to be loving. You know what I'm talking about, that mind? You know, that we acknowledge that is the mind that we don't simply want to wait till it arises like a flash of lightning in the dark, but it is something that we are actively cultivating. When do we cultivate it? Always. And when we are not cultivating it, we know it. Why do we know it? Because it will feel different. Because that altruistic mind, that caring, loving, open, selfless mind, right? When we are in it, when we are living from it, we know what? It feels good. It's kind of simple. It feels good. We feel good. Right? And when we are living in that other, more manipulative, more calculating, more needy, wanting, more egocentric mind, we don't feel good. Even if we get what we want in the short run, right? It is a very different experience than comes from our altruistic mind. The self mind, the selfish mind, and its needs and wants and its successes and failures are very different than the altruistic mind. I mean, is everybody kind of with me? And it's an experience. This is not abstraction. This is not metaphysics, right? This is not spirituality. This is something that all of us know. So it is reinforcing if we are aware, right? I mean, when we are angry, when we are resentful, when we are jealous, when we are anxious, right? When we are despairing, how do we feel? Deep sense of well-being and happiness? No. Again, when we are giving, when we are loving, when we are helping, when we are supporting, how do we feel? Good. Right? It's a no-brainer. Because if we are present to ourselves, we can see very clearly that there is a feedback loop of experience which will let us know that living a life one way is productive of happiness and well-being and a peaceful mind and a calm mind, etc. And this other way of living produces the opposite. Anybody disagree with that? Please don't be shy. Or anybody have a question about it? Yes.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I need a little bit more clarity.
Yes.
Like, for instance, if you have a child who's getting ready to touch a hot stove,
mm-hmm.
or maybe run out across the street,
mm-hmm.
and you don't really have time to use loving, compassionate words.
Oh, no. What is your name?
Crystal.
Crystal. No. If you have a child and your child's about to do something that is going to cause suffering to itself, yeah, I mean, act. But that is that's a compassionate act. Even if you have to grab it or say no, or, you know, something like that. Right? But it's because... It's the intention is to help, right? So this doesn't there's a lot of common sense in this. And again, in Buddhism, compassion does not mean always it's not sentimental, it's not fluffy, right? Compassion means I want to, you know, if I'm a compassionate person, I am not just present to somebody's suffering and just watch, right? Watch it unfold. No, if you're a compassionate person and you are identified with the person is suffering, you want to help them. You want to help them in what way? You don't want to help them continue suffering, do you? That's not compassion. If you're a compassionate person and you see somebody else's suffering, you do not want to do anything that facilitates their suffering, and you want to see if there is an ability or capacity or opening to see if there's anything could be done to alleviate their suffering in some way, right? So that's so does that clarify it? Is what?
Compassion is good.
Good. Yeah, compassion is good. I mean, do we like it when people are compassionate to us? You better believe it. Right? Yeah, we want the whole world to be profoundly understanding of us. We want the whole world to be profoundly accepting of us. We want them to forgive our shortcomings. Right? Yeah, we love it. But, you know, can't be a one-way street. If we realize that when we are the object of somebody else's understanding, their compassion, their help, their support, their kindness, and when we are aware that we are receiving it, it feels good. Right? Well, again, bingo. Could it be that other people feel the same way I do? Well, that's interesting. You know, that means I could be somebody who facilitates well-being in other people. You know, even the people I live with. Now, there's an interesting thing. Right, even the people I live with. You know, look at the people you live with. Look at the people you work with. Look at the people you are in relationship with of all types, and understand that they're just like you. When they are the object of someone else's kindness, caring, support, understanding, forgiveness, you know, right? It will feel good to them. It will feel good to them. And you know what? They'll like you. Right? Because we like people who treat us that way, don't we? Right? Even if in the past we really had all kinds of negative thoughts about them, right? If one day, all of a sudden, they are very kind or supportive or helpful to us, we go, gee, well, maybe I've been wrong about this person. Right? Again, it's kind of that simple. Are there any other questions about this? Living a life of intention, of cultivating continually an altruistic aspiration as the central core of one's life, and that everything else is built around that. Yes.
When you said describe this person you're talking to, you said you felt like you didn't have a sense of direction and intention. And so your first thought was for a second, well, gosh, I'm glad I'm not like that. And then of course I'm like that in all kinds of ways, right? But, mm-hmm. And then sort of thinking about it, thinking, well, I guess more and more when I think about my life and practice and the people in this community in particular and sort of having models and support, I feel like, well, I want to live my life, have this intention at the center of my life to live a life of openness and kindness and compassion, like we're describing, and mm-hmm. that's the aspiration. And I guess I feel like I'm doing, and I can look at my sort of progress, such as it is. Mm-hmm. Well, that's much more in my mind, in my intention. Mm-hmm. It's so hard, in lots of cases, it feels like, to go from that level, right, sort of this ideal of being compassionate to people and skillful, and not, you know, the self, myself not coming out in sort of underhanded ways, right? To go from that sort of like big picture intention to what it means in like a practical, you know, real time case with a person. Mm-hmm. And, I guess there's no
simple answer. Yeah, I mean, no, I think you've answered your question. Yeah, that, you know, we call that practice. I mean, that's practice, right? It's like, you know, how do I take something I kind of intellectually understand? How do I take something that I'm kind of even feeling these days, right? And how do I take that into daily life, into reality? You know, that's why we call our kind of Buddhism, we call it engaged Buddhism, right? Just for what you talk about, because it's not a Buddhism that is practiced somewhere other than life, right? And you're absolutely right, or else it becomes a disconnect. You know, there is my spiritual life, and then there's my everyday life. You know, and you've heard me say before, it always blows me away that you meet people who are, quote, serious practitioners of a spiritual path, and you ask them, how's their practice going? And they say, great. I'm really doing great in my practice. Well, how's your life? Well, that kind of sucks these days. You know. I mean, you see the disconnect. It's like, So it's good to understand that our practice is life. That's what I believe. You know, our spiritual practice is our life practice. Right? Because as you say, where else are you going to practice it? In some ethereal realm? In some abstract intellectual realm? Right? I was talking to somebody yesterday at the workday, and they were telling me about some kind of personal challenge, difficult personal challenge they're having in their life. And I said, yeah, we talked about how to deal with it. I said, yeah. And then we were outside, and I pointed to the meditation. I said, inside there, it's easy. Right? That's a piece of cake, We all sit together, it's all quiet and peaceful, we have bell people, we all smile at each other, and we talk about these wonderful teachings, right? To be happy here, to be peaceful here isn't a lot of work. This is easy. This is kindergarten. But out there, right? In the reality of the ups and downs and the backs and forth of life and all the places the ego gets ensnared and caught and wants to assert itself, that's when practice gets real. That's life. So I think that's a very key part of really authentic spiritual life. It is, that is why. If you're familiar at all with traditional Zen. Right, and if you ever kind of wondered about these, these anecdotes, where somebody says to the Zen master, what is the deepest truth of Buddhism? Right, waiting for a deep answer, and the master says, when I'm hungry, I eat; when I'm tired, I sleep. If you're looking for the deep answer, that could be quite disappointing. Like what? Right? But there's a truth in that. I mean, the truth the teacher is pointing at is the highest truths of Buddhism manifest in the reality of daily life. Right? Another famous master, when asked what is the highest truth of Buddhism or something like that, said, there's a famous line, chopping wood, carrying water. Those were the days when that was kind of normal kind of activity. Again, saying, it's daily life. The truths of Buddhism, the truth of living an awakened life is not separate from washing the dishes, right? From sweeping the floor, from having relationships, okay? So, and this was actually one of the great reforming tendencies within Buddhism that Zen brought. It developed in a time when there was in Chinese Buddhism, a lot of study and metaphysical speculation and philosophical discourse and ritual and all kinds of stuff. And along come the Zen masters, boom. Right. Highest truth of Buddhism. Right. In summer I sweat, in winter I freeze. I mean, these are wonderful lines. Because they kind of bring us back to what? To life, and to that the truths of this mind, the truth of reality, are manifest in the simplest activities of life. We don't have to think it's somewhere else. Any other questions? Yes.
I have a friend that is very close.
Very closed.
Very closed. And you can literally feel the suffering mm-hmm. of this person. You can feel the fear. And there's so much that, you know, would benefit this person by just a crack and opening. And it's challenging to lend a friendship to this person at times because there's just so much fear, it stops communication. Now, how do you recommend compassion? I know I can lead by example and just be in myself, come from an altruistic place and be free and open with myself. But how do you convey that their true self is okay, that it's a comfortable space?
Yeah, not easily. Right. So the question is for the recording, just to be brief, you know, you have a friend, very close, very scared, anxious, the whole deal, and not sleeping, all kinds of, I mean, suffering greatly, and yet is totally closed. Yeah. You know, when we talk, you know, we just talked a few minutes ago about compassion, right? Compassion means we are open to the suffering of ourselves and the world, and we are motivated to heal and transform. On the other hand, two hands, there is wisdom, intelligence, right? And traditionally in Buddhism, they are the two wings of practice. You know, the analogy, of course, is a bird with one wing. Have you ever seen a bird with an injured wing? They just go around in circles. They can't fly. They need two wings to fly. And we need two wings to really manifest, you know, authentically in this life. So we need compassion, so we are present, capable of being present to the suffering of ourselves and others, and that desire to want to help, whether it's ourselves, we want to free ourselves from our suffering, and we want to benefit others, right? So that brings us into the realm of connection, of caring and presence. But obviously, the next step is, you know, well, how do you do that, right? So that's this other wing that has to be cultivated, which is intelligence, understanding, right? And that is, again, a gift that is cultivated. But again, what we could say is this friend of yours who is suffering deeply and yet so closed off to any type of insight or remediation, right? Do you understand her? I mean, do you understand why she's the way she is? Do you understand her past, the causes and conditions that created her? And can you really get inside her to see how she sees the world or sees herself and or sees herself that does not permit any... Can you understand that? Okay. So that's the first step. That's understanding. I understand. I see she's suffering, but I understand why she's suffering. And I understand why at this moment she cannot be open. I understand her wounding. And, you know, that's important. Because if there is no understanding, we just wander into people's lives, right? And sometimes we just make them feel worse. Right? Because we don't accept them as they are. So, I mean, you know, many of us are also kind of screwed up to one degree or another. and can look in our past and go, wow, I really used to be pretty screwed up.
Yeah.
in one degree or another, right? And that's just the truth. And if we think back of that, we can go, and at that time, you know, it wasn't as if there weren't other ways. And there might have been other people in our life kind of giving us good advice that we just didn't listen to, or they made it feel worse, you know. So, to offer your friend your friendship and your kindness and your support is good. If you see an opening, you know, if there's an opening, then you may step in. Or if, you know, my sense also is when you have a friend like that, who you realize is suffering deeply, but yet appears very closed off, and you think you may have something that may be beneficial, I think it's always good to, it's like knocking on a door before you open it. It's kind of a respectful thing to do. You know, we don't like it when people just open the door on us, do we? We hey, how come you didn't knock first? So I think it's often good to say, you know, I hear you. I can see you're suffering greatly. Would you like me to share with you any kind of ideas that I have about how to deal with that? Are you open to that? And let her say yes or no. You know. So again, I think we need to be respectful to people and their suffering, and let her come forward to right. To see if she's seeking advice or counsel or another way. She may not. Just the same way for many of us in our lives, we weren't either. Again, the other side is, I think, with people like that, is at what point, and again, this is subtler, but at what point does our listening to them endlessly repeating the same suffering stories over and over again, at what point are we just supporting it? You know, I mean, that, you know, this is their story, right? And at what point am I going beyond just, you know, being a good listener or a good friend and actually just, maintaining it? And that's an interesting point to come to, and at that point, if you decide no longer to be the endless listener to the same stories over and over again, year after year, you may decide to do something about that, and that may have consequences. It may make them unhappy. They may think you're. You with all your Buddhism. I thought you were supposed to be kind, or you know what I mean? Right? But again, I think, I think there's a lot of wisdom, that we've gained in what we call enabling. You know, people are familiar with enabling. You know, I mean, it's an interesting concept, because the idea behind enabling, of course, is, we can be doing things that appear to be compassionate or helpful, but we're really just, facilitating a continuation of that suffering behavior. And at a certain point, we may want to no longer do that, right? And that's, but again, that's a discernment, right? That comes from the capacity to be understanding. Again, it is easier to be understanding, to be wise, if we are coming into the situation from an understanding, wise mind, and not from ego. Right? Because oftentimes we are really just, it's really about me. You know, I'm not comfortable with this person the way they are. Right? Or I want to change them. Because why? Because I know better. Right? So we have to be careful that we don't, that in our helping, that we're not really advancing our own personal agenda. Either that we are uncomfortable with them, or we think, We can fix everybody. We're the experts.